Welcome back to another episode of Queer Christian Family Values Podcast. Today is a doozy that we're going to be covering. It's going to be
doozy.
It's going to be on Leviticus. I am your host, or co-host, really, Alex Birchnell,
and I'm Andrew Cox.
Yay, there we go. And if you want to support the show before we get started, as always, remember, go to patreon.com/QCFE. And I actually wanted to thank our Patreons because we got a new Patreon supporter as well. So we've got Michael, Rebby, Bash, Jamie, Debbie, August, Megan, and the newest, Noah. If you would like to have your name in the credits during our shows, then subscribe. That's all you got to do. Do it for a dollar. I mean, dollar make you holler, right?
Dollar makes us holler. We will dollar holler. Makes,
yes, we will holler.
For a dollar.
Andrew, how can people follow you or get in touch with you?
Right. Okay. So I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Facebook. And I'm on Twitter. Look up Andrew Harrison Cox, just my full name, no spaces, and you'll find me.
Mr. Alex Birchnell is where you can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. I think I also have a Tumblr technically, but nobody uses Tumblr, so that's another thing. And with that, I think we can dive into it. Okay, Leviticus 18:22 is where we're going to start, and this is how it goes in King James. And I also have the NIV version, but King James, "Thou shalt not lie with man as with a woman. It is an abomination." And then the NIV says, "Do not lie with a man as one lies with a woman. That is detestable." Living Bible says, "Homosexuality is all absolutely forbidden, for it is an enormous sin."
Wait. Help me out here. Some decisions were just made with this text, right?
It was. Mm-hmm.
Could you read the King James and then read the Living Bible?
Living Bible. So
Living Bible. Yeah. Because all right, listeners, we're going to go back to Sesame Street for a moment. It's the street we all wanted to live on. We're gonna visit, and we're gonna play a game called "One of These Things Is Not Like the Other." What is the translation difference between these two texts? All right, Alex, give us the King James.
Okay. "Thou shall not lie." Hold on. Give you the King James. "Thou shall not lie with a man as with a woman. It is an abomination."
Okay. "Thou shall not lie with a man the way" mm-hmm. "one lies with a woman."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. "Thou shall not lie with a man the way one lies with a woman." Got it. What does this Living translation say, Alex?
It took it a leap. It says homosexuality is absolutely forbidden, for it is an enormous sin.
All right, y'all. Let's have a conversation about the difference between translation and interpretation. Am I jumping the gun? Can I?
No, go for it. Just have at it. You've been pumped.
All right. Okay. There are words in other languages that when we translate them, that word means a series of things based on its interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
Okay, I'll give you an example. Yod in Hebrew is basically an upside down hockey stick with a dot, and it means and, but, also, or even. So depending on the context, it means one of four different things, okay?
Language is important, y'all.
Language is important. Now, people are like, well, that should be obvious. It's not. I'm going to give you an example, okay? Okay. In Song of Songs, there is this description of the woman that is the lover of who is assumed to be King Solomon, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In this one moment, it says that she is black or dark. So black, dark, brown, tanned. Like the assertion is of dark, dark skin, even for that culture. Okay?
Okay.
Yod, and then beautiful or attractive. So the word there is beautiful, attractive, or homely. In other words, like passingly attractive, attractive enough, or gorgeous. So like it's a range of possibility. Kind of, and that may sound like, hey, how can language work that way? I'll give you a great example. The word nice in English. Okay.
Okay.
What does nice mean?
It could mean a few different things depending on.
Yeah. But like if you meet someone, like an old lady,
yeah,
you go, she was so nice.
Uh-huh.
What am I saying?
She was probably kind.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now if I go to see, if I watch the Snyder Cut, and you're a DC fan, and you go, how was it? Was it the best thing ever? And I go, it was nice.
It was okay.
It was okay, right?
Like, eh.
If I go on a first date, and you set me up.
Mm-hmm.
And you thought that we were gonna hit it off, and we're going, and he said, "How was the whole evening? Did you enjoy yourself? How was she? How were they? Was it?" And I was like, "It was nice."
It's like you weren't really feeling it fully.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it either means kind, fine, or intolerable.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
That you can do that with so many other languages. I feel like we were doing something in a podcast where we talked about bow, like that word could mean different things.
Right.
Cool. The word cool could mean something different.
Right.
Awesome. Like there's just so many different words, even in English, but Hebrew is crazier because of the, yeah.
because of the poetic license that is so common. Okay. So what happens in this text in Song of Songs is old translations make the yod, but let me explain. Mm-hmm. It says she's black, but she's beautiful.
Almost like the skin color could potentially make her not beautiful.
Exactly. Like despite the problem of her black skin.
Yeah. Well, that's creepy, but okay.
Right. But by the way that it's being suggested throughout the whole text, there is no contextualization that suggests at any point in time that her skin color is seen as a problem to her lover. There is no context for that. It was just an assumption made by white translators that why does he love this black woman and think she's beautiful? Well, she must be beautiful despite being black. That was a leap made in interpretation because of the opportunities in translation.
Gotcha.
So that happens all throughout Hebrew, all throughout Greek, all throughout all translations of all languages at all times. And the reason that we have these two different versions of Leviticus 18:22 is because they saw this language and went, oh, this obviously infers homosexuality. Obviously. So I'm just going to go ahead and call it that. I'm going to go ahead and make that jump to make it easier for people to understand. Now, is that kind of leap unhelpful for the Bible? Not at all. It is super helpful for the Bible. It is only unhelpful when the leap is wrong.
So I'm on the mindset of, first of all, like, so when I started researching Leviticus, Leviticus is a holiness code book.
Right.
But for me, I do not think that, yes, we're no longer bound in, you know, the laws because, you know, Jesus came, tore the veil, that whole thing happened. However, but again, that could just be my personal perspective because Christianity has a wide denomination about views on that. But for me, even though we're no longer bound in those laws, as modern day Christians or mainstream Christians see, I still don't think that it had anything to do with gay people, especially when we start looking at the language. We look at Greek, we look at all these other things to truly understand what they're talking about.
To talk about Leviticus, you have to understand basically the priestly legislative writings that are happening, which start earlier on. Through like Numbers 10 are all of these like legislative practices being given to people, specifically the Jews in the wilderness. And the reason they're given to the Jews in the wilderness is because they are trying to discern the difference between the culture they left and the culture they're going to. So the whole context here is, well, the context they're trying to write for, because it's not being written in the same time that it's suggested that it's being written in at all. But the time that it's being written for is the time period between Exodus and the Promised Land in the biblical narrative.
Sure.
So like, don't be like the Egyptians and don't become like the Canaanites. That's what this whole thing is about. Now, that doesn't mean that these laws are showing us how the Egyptians were or the Canaanites were. Not necessarily. Yeah. But it is trying to make a clear distinction of, here is how you, as the Israelites in the wilderness, can effectively accomplish remaining God's people. That's the whole purpose of this whole text, whether it's holiness, whether it's moral codes, whether it's how to perform sacrifices. All of these things have the same purpose, and that is remaining God's people and surviving the wilderness.
So that stage, there you go. Well, okay. So if we're going to look at the sentence structure and break things down, right. There's another translation. I'm not sure. It's an English translation. A male shall not lay like as the lyings of a woman.
That's the literal Hebrew.
Yeah.
That's the literal Hebrew.
If we're looking at that, it doesn't give you a lot of context of what exactly they're talking about. It could be a number of different things. In Roman culture, it was very common for a man who was married, had kids, to also have sex with slaves. There was pederasty practices and everything.
Right.
But his masculinity was still intact because he was the active partner. He was the penetrator. I know that sounds really messed up, but
he was the penetrator. But also, like, even if you were the penetrator, you could not, like, someone could not ride you. A man could not ride you. A woman could not ride you because that was the dominant position.
Yes.
So, like, there's a lot of really interesting things happening when we think about what is machismo, what is masculinity from wilderness period, Israelite culture, the temple period, the second temple period, the Babylonian exile, the intertestament period with the Maccabean revolts, the early Roman culture. That's six off the top of my head that are going on here. To embody, and that's not even talking about the kingdom cultures from like the North and the South. So like, there's so many different ideas of what makes a man manly.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them most certainly was your ability to be dominant in sex.
Yeah. And like, they kept their masculinity. They kept their honor was a big thing of like, they kept their honor because it was seen as normal. It was almost expected for a man in Roman society, which is, or pagan society, it was common for this to be a thing, for them to sleep around with individuals that did not have honor, like slaves, concubines. There was temple prostitution, which 99% of the time was young boys or young girls. I mean, that was a thing too.
Right.
And so, well,
because they couldn't operate as a legitimate sexual partner
in their culture. Yeah. Well, I mean, in general, yeah, especially if they're minors.
Yeah. So. Because they can't reproduce. Like, they cannot reproduce. They lose that part of this equation of preservation of culture by producing more children.
If you were a receptive partner and you were an adult male, that was horrible because you lost your honor at that point. That's just kind of a stage, but yeah.
These are legislative statutes, okay? These are standards that are considered lawful. Now, we look at this and we go, this is a religious text teaching us about morals. They are trying to set the stage for how people live their daily lives for the purpose of remaining lawful and holy, both. Like, so I mean, for us, we go, well, none of our laws look like this today, necessarily. Not really.
No.
And it's because we, today, we do not insert as much religious language or spiritual language in when we write our laws. It's not necessary, by the way, that we write our laws. The backbone for what they consider righteous or unrighteous is how in favor with God's will you were. So that's why we see these laws written this way. And so if we look at like the whole corpus of like, or at, if we treat it like an elongated pericope, Leviticus 18, like this whole thing.
Yeah.
It is trying to present an ethic to the people through the laws that are being written. And that, I think, will tell us a lot about how we should understand this text. When we look through Leviticus 18, it's pretty fascinating stuff because it is so sexual. There are so many different sexual things, and they're very, very specific, okay? What some Messianic Jews do, and the reason I only target Messianic Jews is because Messianic Jews tend to be rather conservative, usually. They tend to know at least a decent amount of Hebrew. And what they will say is that because the Hebrew is suggesting the both gender and age of the male in the beginning, a man shall not lie with a woman. The woman is also feminine and an adult. Like, that's not the word for a girl, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So a man shall not lay with a, and then there is a non-age associated word for male. Just like male and female, like the separation between the two, male and female, that's the word there.
Yes.
So a grown man shall not lay with male the way a grown man does the lyings of a woman. And that's paraphrasing how the Hebrew would be written out. Okay.
Yes. Gotcha.
I can actually do the exact Hebrew if you want me to. I have my.
Yeah. No, go for it.
Translating. So basically, you shall not lie with a male as with the lyings of a woman. An abomination is that.
Word for word translation.
Yeah. Well, word for word, I cleaned it up a little bit. It's like, would be, with a male you shall not lie, the lyings of a woman, an abomination is that.
Cool.
That's the literal. But that doesn't help you, right? Because it sounds like Yoda, but drunk. It's not helpful. So people like to highlight that the word male here is not specific, as if that suggests any and all possible men ever.
Okay. But
that's not how laws are written. That's not how these laws, like, whenever they want to talk about the kind of animal, they have the capacity to be hyper-specific. Whenever they're talking about, you know, the types of people in your family that you should avoid sleeping with, the laws are hyper-specific. The Levitical legislative writings have the capacity to be hyper-specific, and they are not here. But if we look at, like, the whole corpus of Leviticus 18, we see a pretty clear picture. All of these things are sexual. Every single one of these different things is very sexual. Leviticus 18:22 is unique because in culture at the time, you really don't find an inference against same-sex action like this. This is unique amongst our leaders. And, you know, some would say that's an argument to suggest the holiness of God. Like, well, they weren't being holy and the Israelites were. that's a pretty open claim without any proof.
Yeah.
Because there's
it's more of a leap than anything.
Exactly. Like there's nothing, because all you have to do is say, okay, prove it, and you can't. It's like, well, you find it later in the New Testament. It's like that you're just grasping at straws at this point. So there's one text in this that is not in any way about sex.
Okay.
There's one verse in Leviticus 18 that is locked with these sex passages that has nothing to do with sex. It's about child sacrifice.
Yeah, that would be bad.
But so like verse 21 explicitly prohibits child sacrifice.
Uh-huh.
And it's been included with all these other passages about the way that men have sex. The Israelites were commanded to be fruitful and multiply.
Yes.
The multiplication being through sex and not by converting other people to Judaism. It was all about the bloodline, right?
Yes, it was.
We're talking about just to use some big words here, an ethnocentric theocracy.
Wow.
Because like the bloodline for the entire nation is considered to be holy and worth protecting. Ethnocentric, based around ethnicity and religious practices. And all of these laws and standards are because of the rulings of God. So theocracy.
Yes.
So we're dealing with an ethnocentric theocracy that believe that God has set aside this bloodline to reproduce, to be a multiplied nation.
Yes.
You wouldn't put your sperm on the ground because it cannot produce children. That's why you don't pull out. You would not put your sperm in a man because men can't produce babies.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have sex with a woman on her period because of, you know, all the cleanliness rituals and, you know, all that. But also, they didn't think that women could get pregnant on their period.
Yeah, true.
So, like, and also, I'm not going to get into that. But so kill a child is to actively destroy the agent by which this nation of God spreads.
Gotcha.
And to actively have sex with a man, any man, would actively destroy your capacity, at least in that moment, to continue the means by which the nation spreads.
Yeah. Not to mention they thought that literally life was in the male sperm.
Mm-hmm. And women just basically had like this pot.
Incubator or something going on.
Just like the womb was just like this. The womb was a room and it was just like this thing. So I just want to set that out front. Like if you want like an early, easy argument, also there is no mention against lesbians ever.
Yeah. Ever.
Also, it's not like they just left out the stuff about women because they said that women should not have sex with animals. And they made very specific, like they were so concerned about two things. The insemination through Israelite sperm and the regulation of Israelite uteruses.
Mm.
This is about, go ahead.
I was thinking, is it sacrifice or abuse or corruption? Because I've heard it translated, not necessarily sacrifice.
It is a reasonable assertion to believe that this means to kill.
Okay.
It is reasonable to believe that. Okay. I understand some people would say that that's not it. It is reasonable to believe that this is talking about treating a child like they are the sacrificial lamb to communicate with a god or gods. That is a reasonable thing.
Okay. So, I've heard that.
Put in with this sex stuff.
So, we know we can link it. How would you link it, Andrew? Do you think that they are prohibiting it explicitly, male-on-male sex? Or, like, in this passage, specifically? Or do you think it's really in reference to what I believe, at least, is that it's talking about temple prostitution or pederasty in this case?
What I'm saying is I do not think that this is not talking about consensual male on male romantic sex. I don't think it's talking about that, but even if it was, it would be doing so for a hyper specific reason.
Yeah.
And like the sexual ethic here is in no way applicable to how we think about sex today.
Mm.
Most of us, at least. And And the sexual ethic was is not being written for any time outside of the wilderness. Not really. So even if it was, and it's not, even if it was, it is not talking about gay love. It is not talking about gay romance. It is not talking about anything that would be applicable to what we have today in a more secularized, scientific, birth control, no need to repopulate.
Yeah.
Also Christian, as opposed to Jewish, by and large, society.
Yeah.
So even if it was, it wouldn't matter. That's what I'm saying. But I also don't think it is. Take it away, Alex.
The reason I brought up culture before was that it's all about dominance in the male aspect of things, whether it's Hebrew, Roman, Greek, Egyptian, wherever they're at, it is a very, very male dominated. We see that throughout the Bible. And in the culture that it's in, the man is always having to be the dominant one. And you're going to see later on where it talks about not doing what's natural or forsaking what's natural for unnatural, however you want to put it. These are perceived men. Let me back up. These men, there's no understanding of sexual orientation, right? It's just assumed that if you're going to go after the same sex, it's just out of excess of lust, right?
Right. Or some spirit is acting upon you in this moment to make you have the wrong kind of sex.
Yeah. So they don't quite understand the concept of an attraction or orientation. All they know is there is, outside of the Israel or Hebrew tree, their surrounding cultures typically just assumed everybody's going to have sex with everybody, no matter the gender. That was typically an assumption, especially when it came to an older man, younger boy, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially if the older man is well-to-do, owns land. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's been case studies of sometimes it's like a favor teaching the younger boy how to be a man. There's been instances of it being a slave or whatever. But in every single case, it is still a power play. It is still an abusive situation because they aren't able to give consent. We talked about that. They don't have honor, or they don't have rights to themselves. Right. Same as if they were going to go sleep around with a concubine or a slave woman or even a young girl. Like, it was just a plethora of these men were married, presumably straight men, having sex with whoever the heck they wanted because they could, because they had that power trip, which was just expected in society. In Leviticus 18:22, though, I think it's talking about something very specific to temple worship, pagan temple worship.
So there's this word here that is basically miskebe, okay?
Uh-huh.
Miskebe. That's a shim. Mishkebe. So this word only happens one other time in the Torah. It is unique to the Hebrew scripture.
Okay.
It is plural and it only happens in this way one other time in the Bible. One other time. And I actually found this little article that talks about how weird and rare this word is. Okay. Mishkebe only occurs one more time in the entire Bible besides its parallel occurrence in Leviticus 20:13. In Genesis 49:4, the verse explicitly refers to the incestuous activity of Reuben with his father concubine, Bilhah. That's the only other time it is ever used in the entire Hebrew Bible. While lyings or acts of lying down or beds are possible translations for mishkebe, the comparison to the Hebrew singular word for bed, yatsua, subtly different.
Just a tad.
suggests that the two Hebrew words are not interchangeable at all. And so we see a lot of potential meanings here, right? Pederasty could be one. You know, having sexual temple practices is another super valid possibility here, right?
Yeah.
Exclusively incestuous love because of like the use of mishkave. For some of you that might be listening, that might be skeptical of all these potential meanings, like we're just trying to grab everything except the way that it's been interpreted for the past, you know, brief time in human history. The reason we're doing this is because this is what happens when you need to translate an ancient text. The reason we're doing the work to translate an ancient text so hard and get the culture right is because we got it wrong. We got it wrong. We pretended that it was so clear. And the reason we were able to do that is because denominations and organizations that fund the translation or retranslation of a Bible get the final say. They get the final say on what goes in. This happens all the time where, you know, a team of translators will go, hey, we did the translation work. Here's the three possible meanings. Here's the four possible meanings. Here's how these words could be interpreted. Yes. You'll notice that this line was skipped in the Hebrew. This probably goes here instead. And that stuff happens all the time. It is so super common. That's how often interpretive traditions change. And there's other texts. It is so super common. And the tradition gets to say, we're going to use this one because it aligns with our denominational tradition.
Yes.
That happens. If you think it happens sometimes, I'm talking every time the Bible's translated, that happens. Every single time. We're doing all this work because we got it wrong.
Yeah.
And we have to get it right.
And plus, look at the fruit of what these translations are doing, right? We always talk about whenever we hear a sermon by a pastor, even the most conservative pastor out there, they always talk about the fruit of whatever you're doing, that you will be able to tell something is good by its fruit, right? What is the fruit of translating something as condemning an entire group of people who are dying because of you telling them that they're evil or going to hell or just straight up messed up? Conversion therapy has failed significantly. What was the name of the biggest conversion therapy group that came up, what, in the 90s or whatever? I don't know. Whatever.
But I don't remember their name.
Yeah. They look it up. They were huge, but they failed, and oh, so many people died from this. What is the fruit of it? And I know that that's off of a tangent. That's what we are, but
no, but that's super valid because
yeah, like, that's what we have to relook at this.
We do. Like, we have a Christian tradition today where people will celebrate baptisms and not mourn the suicides, as if both aren't on them. If you look at the fruit of the progressive church and the fruit, or we won't say progressive, we'll say affirming church, the fruit of the affirming church and the fruit of the non-affirming church, only one of those two churches has a body count.
And so, that should make you stop and at least consider looking at the languages and what we're really diving into. And I know, trying to double back, but like we talked about how we were wanting to talk about Leviticus 20:13. But they're so similar in the text that they kind of are grouped together in this at the same time.
Arguably, they are mirrors of each other.
Yeah.
One exists because of the other. So really, today's about Leviticus 18:22 and Leviticus 20:13. Is that right?
2013? Yes, 20:13.
And I'll stand on this all day. Even if it is talking about men not having sex consensually with other adult men, it is so inapplicable in every possible way to what is happening in the Christian world today. Mm-hmm. So inapplicable, because the means of the reproduction of God's people then was Israelite sperm and an Israelite uterus. That was the whole mechanism right there. Yeah. Okay?
Exactly.
Today, it is not that mechanism. The mechanism is exclusively conversion, baptism. That's how God's people are made today, according to Christian doctrine. and for us to pretend that it's this be fruitful and multiply thing. That's not the name of the game, y'all. Like, that's not, in fact, Paul in the New Testament, which we'll get to later. I know. But Paul in the New Testament, he straight up says, I prefer y'all just stay single and just do the gospel. But if you can't control yourself sexually, get married.
Yeah. And we'll address that. So if the listeners have stuck with us since last season, right? We learned about how to read the Bible. The Pauline epistles, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we talked about how each letter written by Paul was a letter to a specific church, right. Specific place, specific time, specific situation. How many times did I say specific? And
Ephesians was written to a larger context on purpose. But go ahead. Yeah.
True. But if we look at these laws, the Levitical laws, they were for a certain time period, certain mm-hmm. people, certain place.
Right.
And you can't just take that and say, okay, well, they're telling this person. That's like telling, okay, so I have celiac, right? Okay. And let's say God came down with a tablet and said, don't eat wheat, barley, or rye. That doesn't mean that the rest of everybody has to do that. Like, it's specific to these people. I know that was a weird jump, but stay with me.
No. What you're doing is you're contextualizing morality.
Yeah.
You're contextualizing ethics. And like, the sexual ethic here is not about attraction. It's not about consensual sex between adults. It's exclusively seeing sex as a mechanism for the reproduction of people.
Yeah.
For specifically the Israelites. We can read this wrong. But we implore you, listeners, understand that these texts only assert the morality that the text allows you to assert. It'll tell you what it's trying to say is moral. But also, very clearly, the Levitical law were not written to you. They were written for a specific moment in time, and it's still useful to learn because you see a culture and you see the bedrock of a lot of different things.
Yeah.
That still makes it fruitful. That still makes it useful. But it is not giving you the way to operate your life, because we're also not telling women to go sleep in tents when they're on their period. That's not
exactly.
So like, please do not take this one verse, which does have New Testament implications that we'll get to later. Mm-hmm. But please do not take this one verse and pretend that it is in some way the only applicable use of this entire legislative body of writing.
So for these specific verses, my struggle is from a conservative, quote unquote, reading of scripture, where I tend to hold them as kind of like word of God in the sense that they were passed down for a reason, right? It's easier for somebody who does not hold it to that same level to grapple with this as being, well, it was for a certain people. It was just a culture thing. Whereas somebody who has high meaning for them, right? So these Levitical laws, they were to help direct into the Messiah, right? Because the line of David, keeping that pure, that is the teaching and understanding of where I come from, is that the point of a lot of these laws were to make sure that that line, that prophetic line, went from Adam, Seth, all the way down the line. Okay. And, but I still think that the argument you're making is still applicable for my view, right?
Yeah. May I try to contextualize it?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. If all of these teachings are from God.
Okay.
Let's just say they are. Let's just say they're all from God.
Sure.
If all these teachings are from God, since they are all from God, isn't knowing how the people of God got here meaning enough? Isn't seeing what they had to do to survive, powerful and emotive and beautiful enough to let it be valuable history, let it be part of the story that gets passed down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes my concern with people is that we pretend, and it is pretending, that everything we hear is for our present day moral day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
When my grandfather had a stroke,
mm-hmm,
and no longer could tell stories, I was robbed of hearing his perspective. But thankfully, others around me would tell his story.
Mm-hmm.
When I heard those stories, I learned his legacy and how I got here. Like what I carry in my body as a person because of what he went through, because I am his. But his decisions do not necessarily determine how I live my life. They inspire my life, but they do not inform it. I'll give you an example.
Okay. That was beautiful, by the way, but yes, go for it.
Thank you. When he got married, he was a mechanic,
mm-hmm,
a good one, but he hated driving. He was taking a long road trip with his new bride. I think if I remember the story correctly, he was driving for the first time on a long distance trip. Every single time another car came down the road, he pulled over. Every single time. In front of him,
okay,
towards him, he pulled over every single time to keep his family safe because he wanted to make sure he did it right.
Yeah.
When I hear that, I love that story. Because he is this giant, like, he's just this giant man, hands as big as your head, like, and I just picture him in this little rinky vehicle with his 5 foot nothing bride stopping every 5 seconds on the side of the road. And I love that story and I love the image of it. And what that tells me is a lot of things. It tells me that he wasn't so proud that he was going to put other people at risk. He wasn't confident enough to drive on the road with other people. And that tells me he loved his wife and others.
Yeah.
What that does not tell me today is to pull over every time I see someone on the road.
True.
So it's valuable.
Yeah.
And applicable. But that doesn't mean I have to mimic it.
Yeah. Not to mention, you're in a different time period, right? In a much less safer time period, right?
Right.
So,
and I know that, and that doesn't mean the story. So some people pretend that when you contextualize it, you're erasing the story. No. You're putting it in its rightful place of value, and that's meaningful, and we shouldn't let go of that.
Yeah. Wow, that was good.
Thanks.
That was good. Thank you for listening to Queer Christian Family Values Podcast with your co-hosts.
I'm Andrew Cox.
I'm Alex Birchnell. And stay tuned because we are going to tackle 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 11 in our next podcast episode, which will come out Friday. So stay tuned. It comes out every Friday. Subscribe to our blog at queerchristianfamilyvalues.com. That way you get the podcast sent directly to your inbox as soon as it goes live. And make sure you sponsor us on Patreon at patreon.com/QCFE to keep this show going. And if you have any comments, questions, concerns, send us a direct message. And with that, thanks for listening.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.